the unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So, as you all know from being at the ceremony, today is the memorial for our founder, the very Reverend Kato Chisan Koho Zenji. It's a mouthful. So happy Founders Day. It's a real seminal, I guess the word is, but it's a real important celebration in our order, because if it weren't for Koho Zenji passing on the teaching to Reverend Master, I don't know if we'd be here in this configuration. Right. And this is a deep day of gratitude for Reverend Master Jiyu's master, Reverend Koho Zenji, and in general, for all those who have made the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives and Shasta Abbey possible. And I think it's a real day to focus on gratitude. And as probably many of you know, that in our tradition, when we found a temple, when a monk founds a temple, it's usually in the name of their teacher. So when we talk about the founder of Shasta Abbey, we talk about Kato Chisan Zenji. So I wanted to start by telling you a little bit about Koho Zenji. Actually, I didn't know a lot of these things till last night. there's a biography written about him, and it's in Japanese. Of course, I didn't read the Japanese, but Reverend Master Mugo had some friends who had been working on translating it. So bits of it are translated. And it's really interesting. You know, I find biographies interesting, inspiring, and he was sure an interesting and inspiring person. And I read through this translation last night after the ceremony, so I want to say that any inconsistencies, errors, or embellishments are a result of my poor reading and comprehension skills, because I'm very weak in those two areas. So, okay. So Koho Zenji was born on August 16th, 1879. It's a while ago. His mother and father were Soto Zen practitioners, and actually they were some of the only ones in that area. There was some other practice that people were doing, but they were Soto Zen practitioners. I think if I remember correctly, they were farmers of some sort, okay? And you know, we're doing okay. Koho Zenji's father was a very big man. It said in the biography that he was built like a sumo wrestler. And as a newborn baby, Koho Zenji was plump. Okay? And his father thought Koho Zenji might grow up to be a sumo wrestler. And it's interesting because apparently Koho Zenji was quite a fan of sumo wrestling. In one of the temples that he was at in Tokyo, it was right near the sumo stables. And he liked sumo. But his father was a really big man. Unfortunately, his father had a bad heart and died a month after Koho Zenji was born. So at that point, his mother and there were two children in the family. Koho Zenji had an older brother. They went to live with his mother's parents, so his grandparents. Okay, and they too were Soto Zen practitioners. His mother's sister and brother were both Soto Zen monks. So he's kind of steeped in Soto Zen from a very, very small age. And I think that both of those, the sister and brother, became the heads of temples later on. Okay. From a very young age, Koho Zenji was an avid reader of books. He loved books. You know, years later, during the war, World War II, when a number of the temples that he had stayed at were bombed, or they were bombed near them, many of the books went up in flames. And he was very sad about this, because he loved books. He was very intelligent. Okay. But from a very young age, he was an avid reader, and he also studied classic Chinese, because in those days, that's what young people studied, if they were fortunate enough to get an education. And so, of course, that would later on become very useful for him in studying the Buddhist scriptures, because many of them are in Japan would have been in classic Chinese. I think that not that long after he went to live with his grandparents, they passed away. And then he had a 4-year-old niece who he dearly loved, and she died. She died of some epidemic. Well, you know, in those days, people didn't live as long, and epidemics would come along. And, you know, this really saddened him. And they began at a very, very young age to kind of turn his mind to the thought of monastic life. I don't know, in reflecting on the Buddha and the death of his mother, so Buddha's mother dies in childbirth, the Buddha is the child, I think that had a real effect on the Buddha in terms of concentrating his mind and looking at the problem of suffering at an early age. And around the time of these deaths, Koho Zenji attended a Jukai ceremony, so that's a precept ceremony, at which the very Reverend Koho Hakugen was the major celebrant, and he also gave a talk. And Reverend Koho Hakugen mentioned in the talk that his mother had died when he was very young, and it left him, you know, for many years very lonely and very sad. So it's kind of resonated with Koho Zenji. And at a very young age, I think he was 9, if I got my years correctly, he asked Koho Hakugen if he could come to the temple and live. And he did that, and then a couple years later, he's 11 years old, he was ordained. So this is November 30th, 1891. Well, and you know, in those days, things moved a little faster. So he became a novice monk at age 11. And he trained under Reverend Koho Hakugen, and he practiced at various Soto Zen temples in that area of Japan. So the rest of the biography is kind of bitty. It's just little bits that were translated, and the chapters were summarized. So I'm taking the rest of my points here from those summaries. Interestingly, his first temple job, when he was at Koho Hakugen's temple, he was the toilet cleaner. And he really worked hard doing that. He worked early in the morning and late at night cleaning the toilets. And it's a very prized job in Japanese monasticism. Throughout his monastic life, he was educated. He was fortunately able to attend school and high school and university. And he was a very good student. And as I said, a very avid reader of both Eastern and Western authors and thought, philosophers. If you read Soto Zen, it kind of illuminates you on how sharp this man was, because he talks of, you know, all these different people that I barely know of. I mean, I kind of know the names, but he knows it. He actually knows what they wrote, and he read it. Okay. There's a really interesting story when he was very young. At the temple he was at, all the young monks, and I think there were a lot of them, they were asked to memorize the sutras, scriptures, okay? And, you know, it was a real struggle for a lot of them. So he asked the monk that was teaching them, well, he said, I'd like to recite them to this scripture to you. Basically the monk thought, no way, you know, I mean, this is a really long scripture. And so anyway, Koho Zenji recites it perfectly, perfectly. And he asked him, the monk asked Koho Zenji, how can you know, how did you do this? How did you learn all this? And he said, well, I studied in the toilet and I studied in my bed at night. So he was a sharp man, okay. And then in his later years, he wrote extensively about Buddhist history. He wrote a lot about Zen in Japan, the history of Japan. He might have ended up a scholar monk. But at one point, what happened, there was a temple that needed rebuilding, and he was asked to supervise it. And that really kind of plunged him into the temple and temple life, and I think it also, people saw his many talents. They said he got right up on the scaffoldings and the like with the workers and was directing them. So he's a multi-talented person. Okay. I did that one. In his 30s and 40s, he was a teacher at various schools because I think the monasteries and temples educated the young people. And he taught small boys. And the person who's writing the biography found someone who was a student under him. And the person said he was very strict and yet very kind. And he had this memory of Ko Zenji getting ice cream for everybody, which was a real treat in those days. And I don't think that strict and kind are necessarily, they don't, I mean, they can work. They're good, you know, it can be a good combination. Over time, he became the abbot of various temples. And actually was fortunate enough years ago to visit three of them. One of the temples, I think it might have been Raigakuji, he became abbot when he was very young. And the congregation thought, I don't know, you know, he's kind of young. Because a lot of times the abbots were a lot older. Okay, and they were a little, you know, worried about, could he really do it? Well, he did it, and he did it really well. And they're really impressed by him. And not only was he a good abbot, but I gather into the wee hours of the morning, he was working on writing the history of Buddhism. He was nicknamed Pumpkin. he asked somebody, he said, why do they call me Pumpkin? He was joking, because he's round. You know, you see his face, he's round. When he's a baby, he was round. He's got that beautiful face. He loved cats. And he would pick up cats and put them on his lap, the temple cats. And sometimes they would be really dirty, and he'd put them on his clean robes to, you know, the horror of everybody else. But he loved cats. And there's a little story of he was at this temple, and there was a temple cat. He really loved the cat. He went away for a while. Somebody who didn't like cats got rid of the cat. I don't think they killed him, but they got rid of the cat. He came back and he was really sad, and he couldn't get they couldn't get the cat back, and he cried because he loved the cat. Okay. They say he always used things until they got really worn out, and he loved rubber bands. His big collection of rubber bands. He reminds me of Reverend Master in some of these things, and he kept any scrap of paper that had any blank space left on it because he wanted to use it. And paper was precious then. He loved to walk. I think he walked all over Japan. There's a number of interesting stories of him going to basically a monastic retreat at some other temple and having to travel a distance. And he's taking this boat ride and almost dies during, you know, the ship almost goes over and the boat almost goes over. And they have to land sooner than they thought, and he ends up walking, you know, 30 miles to the temple. Well, you know, so he liked to walk, and until into his 80s, they say he was, you know, still very vibrant. Okay. There's also there was a little bit about him during World War II. Tokyo was being firebombed. I think I'm saying that correctly. And the temple he was at, he helped. They took the Buddha and they secured the Buddha from the main altar in some place. And then he told everybody, he said, leave. Do not take anything. Just leave and get, you know, go, because now is the time. And then he walked all the way to Sojiji with the firestorm behind him, and somehow miraculously made it to Sojiji. I've covered all those. Yeah, so those are just some bits about them. And again, if I've embellished or whatever, I'm sorry. That's the best I can remember them. I thought that they were interesting. River Master Jiyu, of course, went to Sojiji as his disciple. And, you know, when you think about that, a Westerner and a woman going to this all-male monastery, you know, a few years after World War II, how he pulled that off, I don't know. You know, it was you know, he was I don't think he was a pushover, okay? And he really wanted her to be there. What he saw, I gather, or what he thought that for Zen to come to the West, it would be important that a Westerner brought Zen to the West. Because he said, you know, Buddhism changes as it goes, changes in the externals a little bit as it goes from culture to culture, and you need to know about the culture. And, you know, he thought River Master was the person. He was very progressive and very broad-minded. I think at Sojiji he instituted educational facilities for women. I think there was a school for young women, and I think there's also a nursing school. But he thought education for women was very important. And in that society at that time, that was progressive. Okay? I actually met his niece in Japan. She's a physics professor at Sophia University. So she, you know, she did well for herself, and I'm sure he would be really pleased with that. And she said, because she was a little girl when he was alive, she said that what she remembered about him was his kindness and his attention that he would give her. So she would go visit him at his temple, or he would come visit his brother and the family. And but she said he had that. He always brought a little gift for her, and he had this way of making you feel that you know he was really cared about you. It's kind of that thing that the people say about the Dalai Lama, that you feel like, you know, he's really connecting with you, and he seemed to have that. And as you probably know, when he got really ill and was dying, River Master Jiyu was in the hospital having an operation, and he didn't die until he knew she was okay, as far as I understand it, which, you know, is nice. Okay. So that's just some bits and pieces about Koho Zenji, and you know, maybe hopefully someday we'll have the whole biography translated and be available for us all. On this Founders' Day, it seems appropriate to talk about the cultivation of gratitude in our daily practice. Gratitude, I think, showed up at least twice in the offertory at the end of the ceremony. Remember Master Jiyu used to talk about our practice being the life of gratitude, the practice of gratitude. When we have full morning service, we celebrate the founder ceremony here. Okay, we have the adoration of the Buddha's relics. In the offertory for that part of morning service, we talk about gratitude to the Buddha Kato Chisan, founder of this temple. We also say we show our gratitude and joy to all living things. So gratitude is a word that appears a lot, at least in Soto Zen Buddhism. And Reverend Master Jiyu talked about it as the fifth wisdom, that in a sense it summed them all up, gratitude. Just interesting, show our gratitude and joy to all living things. He It's been my experience that people who express gratitude in their daily lives have a natural lightness and joy about them. Gratitude and joy go together. You know, non-gratitude and snarliness and grouchiness kind of go together. Anyway, I mean, we all have to just look at our own minds and our own lives to see that. We have many formal daily expressions of gratitude in our practice. The gassho, bowing. You know, we bow to each other, and we bow to buildings and halls. We just don't bow to the people we like. We bow to everybody. You know, and it actually cuts through a lot of stuff. Because gratitude is actually about cutting through the stuff. We transfer merit from our daily practice to all beings. You know, we're part of all beings, of course. But that's another form of gratitude. And just in Mahayana Buddhism in general, the bodhisattva training, you know, the idea that of helping beings. Again, we're one of those beings that needs helping. These many expressions of gratitude. I looked up the word gratitude in the dictionary. You know, no surprise. A feeling of thankful appreciation for favors or benefits received. Okay. Remember Master Jiyu said it was a sign of enlightenment, gratitude. Okay, let me read a little bit from Soto Zen. I really recommend this, you know, if you haven't read it, because this is Koha Zenji. And as I said, you can see how expansive and progressive and compassionate mind this person had. He was sharp. Okay. Religion is not something confined to the church or monastery. Nor is it limited to invoking the name of Buddha or doing meditation. It must be revealed in the work we are doing at present. When we assume that each action undertaken in our daily lives rests on a basis of original enlightenment, each act is in itself the act of a Buddha. Then he quotes great Master Dogen, "One's daily actions express one's gratitude for the great benevolence of the ancestors." As we know, Dogen said that really the only way we can express gratitude is by expressing it in our daily lives. In other words, we have to express it in how we live. Our daily lives rest on the basis of original enlightenment. Gratitude is an expression of that gratitude. Each act is in itself the act of a Buddha. So that expressing gratitude in our lives is really the key, because it's not ethereal. It's just not simply a thought. It's just not simply words. It's our lives that show gratitude and express it. Okay? If we want to look at things from the lowest common denominator, you know, in life, even at looking at things in that way, we have to say, well, I could be worse off than them. You know, you can always find somebody that's got a worse predicament than you do. More difficult circumstances. So you can muster a bit of gratitude regardless. And of course, the key to training, I think, is practicing unconditionally. You cannot control what comes your way. It'd be nice if you could. It'd be nice if we were nice and easy all the time. But just the fact that we are born, we age, we get sick, and we die is going to mean there's going to be some difficulty, you know, at least physically. And of course, as we know, there are many, many more challenges in life. And it's easy to be grateful when everything's going right. Not so easy when everything seems to be coming at us in a way that we'd like it not to. And yet, in those very places, we can express gratitude. You know? And it's not about being smiley-faced and, oh, everything's lovely, but it's just about not being cynical, not being one-sided, just opening our hearts and our minds. In Western culture, we put a lot of emphasis on being able to express ourselves and critical thought. And I think that's really good. Those are really good things. But I think they need some balancing. And gratitude is one of those things that you can balance them with. Okay? And it doesn't mean you have to, when something's not good, you have to say, oh, it's wonderful. That's not it. It's just, it's not good, but it's okay. We'll make it. Okay? And, you know, gratitude doesn't mean that we're a doormat. Because we're grateful, people just, you know, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, no. In life, we need to be responsible, act when necessary. But in these moments, in these difficult moments, we can work on letting go of hurt, unfairness, even injustice, and respond from acceptance and compassion. Okay? And move the thing along, too. You know, try to find a better way. Sometimes we need to be direct and to the point. But if we come from the heart of compassion in these times, there's much less of a chance that the old permanent self is going to rise up, you know, and yell out. So I think it's really important to watch our minds. That's an important aspect of gratitude. And don't always express our initial ramblings. I don't know if they're even thoughts, you know. Because as we know, the mind just... And when things are adverse, difficult, it can really just tumble. And you know, our practice is to sit still in that. Not to not act, but to sit still and then act from that stillness. There was a monk who died recently who had an illness they could not recover from, and they were dying, and in a lot of pain. And what they would do each morning when they got up is they would actively think about something to be grateful about. Okay, and they did this day after day after day. Well, eventually, you know, they had to let it go. I think primarily because they'd internalized it, and just deal with the fact that they were dying and the amount of pain they were in, and just, you know, work from that place. But I was really impressed by that, how somebody who was dying in a lot of pain could just every day, you know, they'd get up, sit on the side of their bed, and think of, well, what can I be grateful for? And they would have something. Because, you know, we have something. And on this Founders Day, you know, in particular, we can think of our gratitude towards Koho Zenji. Because if it weren't for him, again, I don't know where we'd all be. Weren't for River Master, it weren't for each other. And what we can do to express that gratitude is pass on the beauty of Buddhism. And we can do that. So thank you.